And we return now to the Russian Energy Forum in Moscow. This took place on Wednesday with Russia's President Vladimir Putin and others from a variety of oil-producing countries.
The price of gasoline in the United States, a gallon of gasoline. I meant the price of petrol, of бензин, not газ.
А ведь это, вы понимаете,
Well, you say that the price of final product, when we talk about petroleum products, is not only dependent on primary oil and gas price. There is also state policy that influences the ultimate price for consumers. And what is the taxation part out of it? For example, some European countries actually increase the price for gas that they buy with us. They increase it nearly twofold. So this is all dependent on policy of the consumer state. So don't point at the producer of energy resources. Just have a look at those who consume it, at their policy, at what they do in order to create a positive price for them.
An investor, energy investor in Iran, had you not pulled out of the nearly $5 billion deal there to develop the world's largest gas field in Iran. Right now, the European Union is looking at a plan that would allow for trade between Iran and other countries, despite the U.S. sanctions, that would allow countries to get around the sanctions. Is that what the EU is talking about with this new initiative? Would that be enough to allow you to return to investing in Iran?
The answer is no. It's no, because we are in a world where one country is imposing its law. And we cannot, Total, which is a global company, we operate in 130 countries around the world, we cannot afford to take the risk to be banned from using the U.S. financial system. That's the reality of our world, and EU is trying to make some efforts, mainly directed, I think, to SMEs rather than large corporations, but the answer is no.
President Putin, let me ask you about this EU initiative. What do you make of it?
This came too late, but better late than never. It came too late because not long ago, President of France, when making a speech in New York, talked about the necessity to increase the economic sovereignty of the European Union, to decrease its dependence on the United States. This is correct. This is absolutely right. Because using political tools, somebody tries to get competitive advantages here in business. I believe that nobody likes it, but this is what's going on. And we see it happening today. That is why taking into account the circumstances to think about some new opportunities, for example, to trade not in dollars. And here I'd like to repeat my idea. I believe that our U.S. partners make a grand mistake by undermining the trust to U.S. dollar as to the only reserve currency. They undermine the trust in it as in the reserve instrument. They literally are trying to break the branch of a tree they sit on. But this is a typical error that any empire makes. People, they think that everything is absolutely okay, that everything is so solid, that there cannot be any single negative consequence. But this is not the case. Negative consequences will be in place. And after that, we understand that our European partners want to comply with their obligations in what regards the Iran nuclear program. and they see an element of stability in global policy in it, which is reflected in the global economy as well.
Ben, I wanted to ask you, have you been surprised by the speed with which countries facing these sanctions, which will be imposed upon Iran in November, have curtailed their purchases of exports and how it's influenced the price of oil?
Well, let me say, first of all, monitoring exactly what is happening to Iranian oil and how that will find its way into the market. We don't see that as necessarily critical or crucial to our business. It appears that indeed the United States is very firm and in its intent to curtail exports from Iran, and that clearly is also being reflected in sentiment into the market. Earlier on, we talked a little bit about price formation. I believe that certainly in the near term, the dynamics in the oil market are very much driven by sentiment, and it could be sentiment around Iran and sentiment about all sorts of other things, imperfect information, which is quite typical for our market, and of course also lack of visibility and clarity about how
it
will develop. All of these factors conspire against a stability in the oil market if not very careful. I have to commend President Putin and His Excellency for the stability indeed that they have brought to markets, because nobody in the end is served by a volatile oil market. The visibility for companies like us or other countries to invest, the visibility on cash flows, comes to a point that indeed we are starting to affect the fundamentals of the market, the fundamentals of supply and demand. So bringing stability is fundamentally a good thing. Where the price will end, I am with the previous speakers on that. That's a function of where the market will land. I would argue that what we are seeing at the moment as an oil price is not an unreasonable oil price. We will need to attract a significant amount of investment that has been curtailed now for the last few years in order to see the market balance for years to come. And bear in mind, of course, we have to look at perhaps what the next few quarters bring, but ultimately the industry cannot bring supply on in a matter of months or quarters, with the exception perhaps of countries that have spare capacity. But industry participants like ourselves don't have spare capacity. We have to make investment decisions, we have to construct, we have to start up, and that comes with delays of 4, 5 years or longer. And therefore, predictability in the market is a good thing to have. And I think we should be grateful for the predictability that has been brought about over the last few quarters and years.
Thank you, President Putin. I'd like to go back to Iran for a second. One of the things that the United States would like to see Iran do is to obviously withdraw from Syria. The U.S. National Security Advisor just last week said that the United States is going to now stay in Syria as long as Iran and its proxies are there. Russia's been very clear. Russia says that the U.S. military's presence in Iran is illegal. What can you do about the U.S. being in Syria?
There are two possibilities in order to stabilize the situation, to improve it. First of all, the U.S. should get a mandate of the U.N. Security Council for the presence of their armed forces at the territory of a third country, in this case, at the territory of Syria. Or they should get an invitation of the legal government of the Syrian Arab Republic in order to bring their military personnel to the country. There is no other third way of ensuring the presence in the international law.
To change the U.S.'s position. The U.S. says it's going to stay, that Iran has to leave, and the U.S. will stay until Russia, until Iran pulls out of Syria. So what can Russia do?
The U.S. in this case, as we understand, can just easily resort to reading the U.N. Charter. Then they will see that I am speaking the right things. There is nothing new about that. The U.S. in this case are violating the U.N. Charter and the international law. Their military presence at the territory of another country of the country they are present at, so without the resolution, without any permissions, without invitations. It's illegal. There is nothing good about that. Proceeding from the fact that we still do cooperate in Syria with our U.S. partners in combating terrorism, in combating the terrorists of the Islamic State, but while the Islamic State organization is being eliminated at the territory of Syria, we are still not getting any international explanation, legitimization of why the U.S. is longer present there. Or we should strive for the situation when there would be no, absolutely no foreign forces at the territory of Syria. Yes, including Russia. If the decision will be taken at the governmental level of the Syrian Arab Republic.
Do you think that that's going to hold?
What does it have to do with oil, I wonder? Well, perhaps it has something to do with oil, if we consider that Syria is also an oil producer, and still there is some influence on the markets. In this case, that's true. We need a stable Syria, without a doubt, and not to mention other aspects, speaking about the international security and combating terrorism. That is a very good deal, I'd like to say, between Russia and Turkey in this case, because it meant let us avoid yet another bloodshed. You see, the essence of the deal is that we agreed to create a demilitarized zone 15-20 kilometers deep within the de-escalation area in the vicinity of Idlib, that is the Idlib area. And I'd like to point out that right now we truly proactively work on implementing these agreements. And our Turkish partners, too. We see that. We are thankful for that to them. We appreciate that and are going to work with them further with the support of Iran in this case.
To energy, President Putin, and talk about Nord Stream 2. That's the pipeline that Gazprom wants to build between Russia and Germany. Again, the President of the United States has said his opinion about this. He says that Germany is effectively a hostage already of Russia because it depends on Russia for so much of its energy and gas supplies, and that it's vulnerable to, quote, extortion and intimidation from Russia. What do you make of that?
My comment will be short and simple. Just in a briefly, in Helsinki, we have spoken about that with Donald. Speaking about any trade, about any sales, shipments, and deliveries, we are a traditional producer. Starting with the 60s of the previous century, we are delivering gas to Europe. We do it highly reliably, in a professional manner, in the competitive spirit and on the competitive prices for the European market. And if we consider the peculiarities of the gas market as such, the price depends on the volumes of the supply between Russia and Europe. The distance is so long that it is most reasonable to deliver pipeline gas. In this case, the price will always be competitive. Experts do understand that always. Here, near me, there are a lot of people who are experts, who can freely sit near me and provide you with their expertise. They will provide assurance of my words. Thus, Nord Stream 2 is a purely commercial project. I'd like to underline that. It is linked to the increase of energy consumption, among other things, in Europe, first of all, and the reduction of energy producing in Europe. Thus, they need energy. What can be done in this case? We provide 34% of the required energy to Europe. That's a fair share, but that's not a monopoly. Europe can get, for example, gas from other sources, and they do. However, The liquefied natural gas coming from the U.S. on the market is 30% more expensive than our gas. Just imagine the situation when you want to buy some resource of the same quality, and then you have a price that is 30% higher. If you are rubbed at that, then the common competitiveness of the German economy will critically decline. It is crystal clear for everyone. Still, business is business, work is work. We are ready to work with all the partners. You know, the German partners have started the construction stage at sea. We also get to that. We do not have any more problems always getting the permissions. Finland has taken its decision, Sweden too, Germany, Russia, all the decisions and permissions are here. That's enough for us, and the project will be fulfilled.
In general in a second, but as you said, two of our five participants in this panel are in fact either directly or indirectly investors and partners in Nord Stream 2. Ben, the CEO of Shell to your left, is one of them. You know, the U.S. has threatened to sanction European companies that invest in this project. Are you at all concerned about running afoul of the U.S. administration?
Well, let me first of all say that President Putin's macroeconomic analysis is entirely correct. It's clear that Europe will need more imports. Indigenous production in Europe is in decline. We will need to import in Europe from a multiplicity of sources, as we have been doing for some time. Russian pipeline gas, pipeline gas from North Africa, LNG from all over the world. Hopefully, at some point in time, also LNG from the Baltic, from Russia. And, you know, Russia has been a very reliable supplier of gas for many decades under different political realities, and that needs to be recognized as well. So if I just for a moment put my European hat on, I think it makes eminent sense for European countries and economies to avail themselves of the infrastructure that will give them maximum optionality. Prices will ultimately be set by international markets. And I would also agree with President Putin that the cost of supply of Russian gas is probably one of the most competitive ones. And therefore, it will be most likely LNG at the margin that will set European prices more than Russian pipeline gas. So we are participants in the project. We have been participants in this project for a number of years, of course. We've done that with the authorization of all relevant authorities, with the consent of Washington, may I add. But of course, what we are seeing at the moment is a political dynamic that we are being caught up in. I'm not a politician, I'm not a diplomat, I'm a business person. We have to do the right thing by our shareholders, but we also have to take the realities of the legal system that we have to live in. If the United States, for reasons that they believe are important, will sanction us or the project, then we have no choice. And I'm actually quite philosophical about that. I have no other choice.
No choice but to exit the project.
Well, let's see how that plays out. It depends, of course, very much on what the United States decides it wants to do.
President Putin, did you want to jump in here?
We understand the reality of what's going on. We highly respect all of our partners. We have long-standing, very good, very cordial relations with all of our partners, including the company that is represented by my neighbor from the left. These are the companies that work at the Russian market, and they do work successfully. We understand, however, what's going on. Thus, we implement the project with our own resources and forces. We might have some problems here, but if they arise, we'll solve them, I assure you. There are issues that are more important than political manipulations. For example, speaking about the deliveries to the Federal Republic of Germany, perhaps not all of you know that in Germany a decision was taken to close nuclear production plants. However, in the total balance of energy of the country, 34% was attributed to the nuclear energy. We for ourselves are proud by our nuclear energy sector, but we have 16%, and we are looking forward for achieving 25. However, Germany had 34 and is going to give it up. There will be an enormous vacuum that has to be fulfilled. Just have a look. Our competitors and partners suggest that they can use LNG. It's true, in the total basket there should be LNG for Europe too, but from all the LNG ports that already exist in Europe, do you know how many of them are used? Only 25% of the facilities are used. Why? Because it is not profitable. Because there is business and there are regions which profit from getting LNG. It is beneficial to deliver and sell LNG to them. That's why the LNG market grows. But Europe is not the place. Thus, we have already fulfilled all our intentions with Nord Stream 1, and it is functioning successfully while the deliveries to Europe are constantly growing. 194 billion of cubic meters have been delivered to Europe last year. As far as I remember, this year we are going to have about 200. Blue Stream is functioning to almost to its full capacity. All the other pipelines too. However, the demand still grows. That's why it's important that we do that.
It's perhaps a little bit more nuanced. His point is that instead of buying Russian gas, even perhaps if it's a bit more expensive, the Germans and other European allies of the United States, because the United States is paying for their defense, should be buying American gas. Even if there's, I guess the argument suggests, a little bit of a higher price for that.
Oh, well, you know, this is not really a very good argument. However, I see Donald is protecting the interests of his country and his business. And perhaps if I were him, I would do almost the same. However, the US LNG is not a bit more expensive, but 30% more expensive. It's quite a bit. Too much, I'd rather say. It's, in fact, doesn't make the plan implementable. However, there are some markets where LNG is efficient. For example, the Asian Pacific region. By the way, the first shipment from our new facility at Yamal Liquefied Natural Gas Facility, the first tanker, where did it go? It went to the US, you know. Why? Because it brought profit to the businessmen. That is the consequences of market. Who did buy the first oil tanker? The U.S. did, because it was profitable at that time, at that place, at that time, and they did buy it. And still the deliveries are sent to the American continent because it is profitable. One cannot fight with these trends of the market. One just should look for mutual approaches to create favorable conditions at the market, among other things, for oil recovery in the U.S., for oil consumption and gas consumption in the U.S., so that suppliers and customers will find themselves in favorable conditions. One can do that while harmonizing the policy lines, not by imposing some decisions on one partners. Speaking about the argument of providing protection in return for unfair trade, I believe it's not the right one. What is the result then? The Europeans today are starting to speak about more independence in providing security of their countries, that they should perhaps create their own security and protection union that will not be competitive in the face of NATO, but still will ensure that they will have a better security policy. That is the result of such maneuvers, as far as I know. And thus, I believe that much will be changed through life itself.
A little bit the argument that President Putin made. We have contracts to import LNG from the US. They started delivering cargoes to us this year. So far, these contracts were designed and entered into to be shipped to Europe. But so far, we have sold these cargoes to Asia, Southeast Asia, not to Europe because of economic convenience. There is no economic convenience today to sell LNG into Europe when you can sell it elsewhere where prices are higher. So LNG is a great commodity. It's liquid, you can move it around, and it's very difficult to compete with piped gas so far in this part of the world. It's as simple as that.
Patrick.
I just would like an argument. I went to Washington and discussed with Rick Perry and Steve Mnuchin. You know, we are Total investing in US LNG, also in Russia LNG. And I told them, you know, as a US investor in the LNG plant, I don't want to send my LNG to Europe. My target is to send it to Asia. So your argument that US LNG should go through Europe is not at all the interest of business of people who are investing in the US today. So all that I think is wrong. We should let the market strength. You are in a liberal market, a free market in Europe, and then let's competition. And in fact, US LNG somewhere is putting a ceiling on the gas price in Europe, which is good for European consumers. Let the competition go, and Ben was perfectly right, maximize the number of infrastructure and the most competitive sources of gas will be bought. That's very simple. And I think there is a big mistake to mix politics, geopolitics, and energy, because at the end, it's the consumers who would pay all that. And we should think to that in a continent where we will rely, our energy in Europe is relying upon importation, which is fundamental for the economic growth of the continent.
Pekka, let me give you an opportunity. Fortum has a 47% stake in Uniper, which is one of the five financial investors in the Nord Stream pipeline. I wanted to give you an opportunity to speak.
Okay, thank you. I'm, of course, an electricity guy, so I comment from that point of view. And to continue on what President Putin said about Germany shutting down nuclear, which will significantly affect the energy balance, of course, we also need to remember that currently Germany is producing 40% of their electricity with lignite or coal. And in Germany, as in all Western European countries, because of the need to reduce emissions, the pressure on coal will also increase. Europe's own production of gas will go down, as has been mentioned here. And at the same time, 2020s will, in many respects, be the decade of electricity. It was mentioned here that the share of electricity in final consumption of energy today is, it is about 20% today. It will grow in the future. We will see electrification of traffic. We will see electrification of decentralized heating in many parts. We will see electrification of some significant industrial processes. And the fact is that in a country like Germany, if you shut down nuclear and if you want to reduce the use of coal, it is not going to be enough to just have a lot of wind and solar and maybe some hydro. When you are without nuclear, then it automatically means that the strategic importance of gas as providing security of supply and providing balancing power for peak consumption hours will grow. So from that point of view, we have a very pragmatic approach to this whole question. We see it as a purely commercial project that makes sense. And as a shareholder in Uniper, we obviously expect them to honor the commitments that they have made.
Minister Falek, I was not expecting so many people wanting to weigh in on this issue, but we're delighted.
Well, I just want to come from the angle of Saudi Arabia. And we talked about the policy coordination and oil market stability, but investing in Russia has been an area that we've looked at. And in addition to oil field services, where we've already made some investments with the RDIF. Kirill Dmitriev, and under the guidance of President Putin, have made it obvious to us that there are great technologies, great companies, great business drivers here that brings foreign direct investment that adds value to investors. But in the area of LNG in particular, I've attended the inauguration of Yamal 1, and Saudi Aramco today is in advanced discussions of being a partner with Novatek and Total and other international partners to participate in the next phase of developing that great resource. And what we've discovered over the last 2 years is that, unlike this image that has been painted, that this country is closed, that it's a monolithic state control, that it's actually quite capitalistic, quite market-driven, investment conditions are attractive, and we will have our right, if we proceed with this investment, to offtake the LNG, to take it to global markets, mostly Asia, but if we need it in the kingdom and in the region, as the president suggested to me in Yamal, to replace burning of liquids, we will be able to do that. So I would just say from our perspective that there are great resources, great conditions, and the market forces here in Russia are very conducive to globalization and to allowing this competitive, healthy process of bringing the cheapest resource in the global landscape to the markets that need it.
Please.
Let me perhaps add one more thing to what was just said. We've been investing in Russia since already almost a decade, okay? We have been changing our investment horizon over the years. We have been investing in oil and in gas exploration and production for some time, then sold. We have been investing, and we are in one of the largest energy producers. We have started an investment program through Enel Russia with our co-shareholders, RDIF, in renewables that is now coming into the system. What we try to see here is that the whole changing specter of technologies that are affecting the energy world, and that includes the big digital effort that I think Russia will start to pick up with Rosetti at guiding this, is that in Russia, maybe this is not something that everybody is aware of. Russia is one of the luckiest countries in the world in terms of energy. There is not a single form of energy that lacks in big scale. So the choice is perhaps even too much. There is an incredible combination of energy sources that Russia can play with. And what we have observed is that across this time period, the logic of development of different energy resources has been quite straightforward and well organized. And it has been perhaps driven by the idea that energy in itself is not something that you can build your life around. Energy is good because it develops society, it develops an industry, it develops technological growth. Today, the fact that you start here in Russia to see renewable energy coming in is not because you lack energy. You could go on for ages without renewables in Russia. But putting renewables into the picture develops a full new industry that can pick up and become another competitive battleground for Russian industries. So industry is the core of welfare for nations. Energy is just an enabler for industry to develop. And I think that's the way in which Russia started to see this from the beginning, and that's why we remain in this country, because we see this logical connection between the development of the economy and energy, and not just energy on a standalone basis. Because energy alone is nothing. Even if we are all energy people, we should be aware of that. Energy is nothing without society that uses it.
Thank you. We have so many topics that I want to cover, but we can't leave the subject of LNG without giving the floor for very briefly to Ben, who just did the biggest deal in LNG in 5 years, $12 billion investment, LNG Canada. Why the optimism?
Yeah, thanks, Ryan. We sanctioned the Canadian LNG project yesterday morning. Been a project in the making for quite some years, of course. But we believe it's the right project at this point in time, right location, aiming for the right markets. But also the timing is right. We are looking at a market that will be tightening up in the next few years. Already we see some tightening in the LNG markets. The 20s, we will probably see that demand will remain unfulfilled in very significant proportions. So having a project come in that is competitive, both from a financial perspective, a resource quality perspective, ecological perspective, this will be the lowest carbon footprint LNG by a large margin ever built, is the right thing to do. But I would be remiss sitting here in Moscow talking about a Canadian LNG project if I wouldn't also mention two Russian LNG projects that we are in. We are still in the leading LNG or the first LNG project in Sakhalin, where we are looking very much to expand that project. That project is probably even more advantaged in terms of where it is, location-wise, in the middle of markets, with a fantastic track record. It's the best LNG project in the world in terms of its performance and track record. And we're working together with Gazprom on another extremely promising LNG project in the Baltic, which will service a very dynamic market in the Atlantic Basin. Both projects that have, in my mind, tremendous potential and fit in the same way, right into that period of tightness in the market that will be coming up in the 2020s. So we are optimists in LNG. We are, of course, a very large and sophisticated player in it. We've built that capability up over years. We intend to be the leader in this industry, and we believe this industry has a long running room ahead of it, including in Russia.
Just a word to say that Canada is competitive, but Yamal Peninsula is more competitive, and that the Arctic 2 project will be even a step forward in terms of competitiveness compared to Yamal. We are building together with Novatek, I see Leonid Mikkelson, hello. We are building a huge province of LNG there in the middle of nowhere. Nobody was believing in this project 7-8 years ago. It was considered in the industry as one of the most crazy ones, but I must ensure everybody that with the support of the Russian government, which has helped in spending money on infrastructure and which is continuing to open the northern route, we are building there one of the, I would say, new province for LNG for the world. And I would pray thanks, Mr. President Putin, for his leadership. And again, I think it's just a startup of a story, and that will be one of the largest province of gas, natural gas in the world. So thank you for your support.
President Putin, let's get back to geopolitics. When you were talking about oil, and when everyone talks about oil and disruptions on the market, they don't just talk about Iran, they talk about Venezuela. You mentioned Venezuela at the beginning of our conversation. Last year, I interviewed the president of President Maduro, the president of Venezuela here. Venezuela is an ally of Russia. Russia has a lot of oil interests in Venezuela. Oil production in Venezuela is not going well, and politically things are going very poorly. As you know, millions of people are leaving the country. There's hunger. There is a lot of talk in the United States, and not only in the United States, in Central and South America, that perhaps it's time for President Maduro to go. Do you agree with that?
The people of Venezuela has to decide on that, and nobody else in the world. As for various instruments and tools to influence the situation in Venezuela, well, we understand that we all influence each other, but nobody should use tools that deteriorate the situation of the civil population. because we cannot be happy that people suffer there. We do not want them to live a worse life than they do now. Recently, there was a terrorist attack against President Maduro. Do you say that we have to approve of such tools? They are absolutely unacceptable. The people has to have the right to decide on their own fate. Nobody can impose any sort of decision on them when the situation there has been built throughout the history, and same situation was in Southeast Asia and on other continents. No one can interfere into it while not understanding what's going on. It will be like an elephant breaking into a glass store. People have to decide. This is my take of it. And I wanted to get back to the previous issue since we are talking about energy here. I'd like to comment on what my colleagues have mentioned about energy resources and energy capabilities of Russia. They're immense indeed. We rank first in gas stocks, 73.3 trillion cubic meters of gas. You have been talking about Yamal Peninsula, but we plan to launch another project, Arctic 2, at another peninsula, and the total amount of investment will be 25 billion USDs, whereas the first project had invested 27 billion USDs. We rank third in oil stocks in Russia. Well, take into account that the area of the country is the biggest in the world, and I believe that we can exploit and survey further, and we will discover additional stocks. So this is what was given to us by God and what was developed by the previous generations, and we do not have, and we cannot forget about it, and we'll further on work with our partners. I'd like to pay attention to the fact that almost any major energy company is active in Russia.
EU countries and Iran, I couldn't help but remember that Russia itself, faced with sanctions, is thinking about a plan to wean itself off of the dollar. This is something that many countries have tried and failed. Why does Russia think that it can succeed in this?
Вы сказали в прошедшем времени или это неточный перевод?
Did you say it in the past tense or was the interpretation incorrect? Well, sometimes I think that everybody who wants to impose sanctions on us should do it at once. All of them at once, because this would allow us to protect our national interests using the tools that we think are the most effective. But generally speaking, it is very harmful. It is very harmful for those who introduce sanctions. That is why we will never support sanctions introduced apart from UN.
Russia is facing even more of them, perhaps as soon as November. What is Russia prepared to do to change the trajectory of relations with the United States and the West?
We do not the ones to introduce sanctions against US or Western countries. We make reciprocal steps, but they are very reserved ones. We have been very careful. We do not want to harm ourselves. As for Skripals, well, this scandal is being artificially blown up and extended. And I know that some media, some of your colleagues, tried to promote the idea that Mr. Skripal is a rights advocate. But as a matter of fact, he is a spy, a traitor. There is such a notion as a traitor. The man who betrayed his fatherland. He is one of them. Just imagine the situation. You are a citizen of your country. All of a sudden, in your country, there is a person who betrays it. What is your relation to him? Just think of it. Really, that he... Normal reaction would be to say that he's a scoundrel. But around this situation, a whole informational campaign was launched. I hope that it will come to its end. The sooner the better. Me and my colleagues have multiply talked about it and asked to provide us a document, a material. We would then have launched an investigation. I believe we have an agreement with Great Britain of assistance in criminal investigations. Just send it to us. Send us the materials. We will direct them to prosecutor's office and we'll investigate it. We'll help you. As for battling between special services, well, you see, espionage is one of the oldest professions in the world, just as prostitution.
Two other issues. One is the use of chemical weapons, and let's not forget that in addition to the Skripal family being affected in that attack, there was also a homeless person who was killed when they came in contact with nerve agent Novichok.
Послушайте. Травили Скрипалетом.
So, listen, please. Now we are speaking that allegedly Skripal was poisoned, and now you are speaking about some other strange person that was poisoned. There are too much speculations around this case. Just do you imagine that some guys have come there and started to poison homeless people? Where do they work then? No one needs to poison others. I've said Skripal is a traitor. He was caught. He was punished. He spent all in all 5 years in prison, and we let him out. And that's it. He left. He worked in Great Britain and consulted some special services there. And what of that? About what we are speaking right now? About oil, gas, or about espionage? What was your question then? Well, fine. We can discuss another ancient job. We can discuss what's going on about that, too. Why not?
Today goes back to Russia's relationship with the United States. And so I'll ask you just a couple of questions about that, and we can move on. The U.S. says you personally ordered the 2016 interference in the elections. I know you deny that. You have said you wanted Trump elected. What do you want to see in 2018 from these midterm elections?
Do you mean in Russia or in the U.S.? About what are you asking?
In the 2018 midterm elections in the United States.
I will be serious in this issue. I want all this nonsense to stop. The nonsense that has to do with some fantasy meddling of the Russian Federation with some election campaigns in the U.S. so that finally the elites of the U.S. would come down, would figure out what they want from each other, and they would be able to restore balance, just like in the oil markets, the balance between common sense and the national interests, I mean, so that the domestic feuds within the U.S. would not poison the Russian-U.S. relations and have a negative impact in the world.
I'll ask this final question on the political front. In Helsinki, you said that you wanted President Trump to win because he favors better relations with Russia. But in fact, as Russia itself says all of the time, relations between Russia and the United States seem to get worse every day. Wouldn't it be better for Russia to have a president in the United States that is not politically compromised by the widely held perception that this country helped him get into the White House?
First of all, I do not think that President Trump was somehow compromised. He was elected. People voted for him. That was the choice of the people. Someone might not want to respect the opinion of the electors and voters in the U.S., but it's not our business. It's the business of the U.S. What's better, what's worse? Politics do not allow for such speculations. It could have been worse. We do not know. We proceed from the situation we have now and are going to work. Proceeding from that, we do not know whether it's for the good or for the bad, but we do not have any other president, and we do not have any other country instead of the U.S. It is a major world power, a leader in many fields, our natural partner in a whole spectrum of tracks, including international security, non-proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, combating terrorism, combating climate change, protecting environment, and so on. We have a lot of overlapping joint challenges and problems, and we should solve them together. We proceed from the fact that sooner or later, the time comes when we will be able to restore the relations 100%.
In this conversation? bringing this conversation to perhaps an end, you know, it dawned upon me this year, and this is only anecdotal, that you know, wherever I went in the world, it just seemed, you know, there was record temperatures, and the issue of climate change is real and has to be dealt with. I wanted to ask the members of the panel if one of you you had this same sort of epiphany this year and said something has to be done.
Perhaps this is not the years of epiphanies, but it is certainly the year in which we are all going to understand what is going on in the energy transition, which helps. It goes in the direction of helping climate change. The World Energy Outlook of the International Energy Agency that will be published, has been announced already, shows that while energy demand of the world is growing, the electricity portion of energy demand is growing twice as fast, which means that the world is progressively electrifying its energy consumption. This happens while it is increasingly available and it is increasingly possible to decarbonize the energy mix. So while competitiveness of renewable energy sources is drastically decarbonizing the world energy mix, the world is using more electricity. And if you start using a decarbonized electricity into transportation, industry, and other segments of human activity, you decarbonize them too. And so there is not only an effort to say, okay, I have to reduce the CO2 percentage of my energy electricity production, just use electricity more and more, because that is going to be decarbonized by the economics. And that's good for the environment. That's something that we were not fully aware until, say, the beginning of this year. This is now becoming a big trend worldwide, of course, with different speeds. This is not the same everywhere. But it's a good news for those that, with some exceptions in a big country at this moment, but for those that think that there is a climate change and it is man-made.
Ben, I want you to pick up on one point there. We heard Francesco there alluding to the fact that one country in the world is rolling back a lot of the regulations to mitigate climate change. That's obviously the United States. The Trump administration has rolled back a number of these things. And yet it seems like many people in the oil and gas industry remain concerned, even though there's some let up on the pressure in the United States to take action.
Well, a few points, Ryan. First of all, we didn't need the weather events of this year to be convinced that climate change is a real issue that we have to deal with. This has been with us for some time. We know that it has to be tackled. We also know, by the way, as an energy player, that this is a challenge of tremendous proportions, not in the least because we have to match it up with, as Francesco says, growing energy demand, and also lifting a lot of people still out of energy poverty. So the challenge is absolutely tremendous. In quite a few cases, it gets actually sort of simplified in people's mind by suggesting that we can actually deal with this challenge by just more renewables. But we have to bear in mind, if all power generation was renewable, we would only have solved 1/5 of the energy consumption problem in the world. So the problem is much bigger than we imagined. I would like to come back to a comment that President Putin made just a moment ago, and I will talk about President Trump in a moment as well. The challenge is actually that we have insufficient worldwide collaboration on this problem. We tend to have, when it comes to climate change, we tend to have either a festival of opinions or we have everybody disagreeing with everybody else. And really, we don't have time for that anymore. We actually have to start working together and collaborating on a scale that hasn't been done before if you want to have a net zero emission world by 2070, because that's what it will take globally to get to below 2 degrees centigrade, as we know Paris has agreed. And I think at this point in time, again, much of the bandwidth is being lost by disagreeing and coming with competing opinions. On the United States, yes, of course, it's on the one hand true and attractive to comment that, you know, the United States has abdicated and has pulled out of Paris and or is in the process of doing so. But the other thing we have to bear in mind that the United States is also a great example of actually reducing emissions by doing the right thing, which is switching from coal to gas. This happened partly because of regulatory pressures, but predominantly this happened because of economic pressures. It just made economic sense to do so. So if you look at the amount of emission reduction that has taken place, the United States actually stands out as a great example. And the only other place where I see a tremendous amount of progress being made, or at least the intention to make progress, is in China. And that is indeed very much driven by policies, and of course also driven by a desire to improve air quality. But I think, indeed, we have to work together, not only as industry, but definitely also civil society, governments, consumers as a whole, to figure out how we're going to do this collectively without trying to somehow push the problem to somebody else or to another player, least of all to energy producers. If I just draw a quick parallel, if we are going to solve the problem of obesity in some countries, we're not going to solve it by attacking the agricultural sector. We are going to solve it by actually attacking the consumption and not necessarily the production of food. Thank you.